Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of those and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash App, Moral Hospital, and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Internal Medicine Podcast, where we use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. Today, we are actually giving Matt and Paul a break. So if you have never heard our voices before, I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and I'm here with Dr. Sean Cohen. And we are actually going to bring you an episode today of the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, which is our mini-series on substance use disorders. Today, we have a super exciting episode with Dr. Jesse Merlin on chronic pain management in patients with opioid use disorder. But before we get too much into what we're going to chat about today, Sean, will you remind the audience what we actually do on this miniseries?
I will. I feel like we finally made the big time that we get to do to host the Curbsiders Internal Medicine Podcast without any supervisor. So we are the addiction med podcast and miniseries that uses expert interviews to demystify common addiction med topics, reduce stigma. We get to talk with people that inspire us and teach us things every episode and hopefully inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for everybody who uses substances.
And this podcast is brought to you by the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. ACAM provides educational resources to help you deliver evidence-based care for patients with substance use disorders. Strengthen your clinical knowledge with ACAM didactic curriculum featuring expert-led sessions on managing substance use disorders in real-world settings. So if you're looking for board prep tools or interested in testing your knowledge or your team's knowledge on key concepts, make sure you check out the ACAM question bank. So learn more at ACAM at ACAM.org.
Today, we have, as Carolyn said, a genuinely incredible episode that I feel like was practice-changing for me. And so we are joined by Dr. Merlin, who is a professor with tenure in the Division of General Internal Medicine and director of the Challenges in Managing and Preventing Pain, called the CHAMP Clinical Research Center at University of Pittsburgh. And hot off the press, on July 1st, she's going to be the inaugural director of the Supportive Care Research Center at the James Cancer Hospital and Director of Palliative Care Research in the Division of Palliative Care at The Ohio State University. She's a physician and she is board certified in internal medicine, infectious disease, palliative care, and addiction medicine. I mean, I don't know. It's so incredible, to be honest. Such all very useful, all very useful fellowship. And she's also a PhD trained behavioral scientist, NIH-funded clinician investigator with an NIH-funded program of research that focuses on the intersection of chronic pain, opioid misuse, and use disorder across populations, including people with cancer and HIV and settings including cancer centers, HIV patient-centered medical homes, primary care clinics, and opioid treatment programs, or OTPs. Her work is widely published in great journals, including New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, JAMA Oncology, JAMA Network Open, and the American Journal of Public Health, which you know are amazing journals because I don't get published in any of them. And she is passionate about mentoring early career scientists. And she really, I think, takes us really through how you can address chronic pain effectively, talks through kind of that people can have both chronic pain and opioid use disorder, that they do interact. And I think not only focuses on what are the effective interventions to help people, but how do we integrate those into whatever care setting we're working in, whether that's a primary care clinic, palliative care clinic, or an addiction clinic as well. I promise you this episode will not be a pain to listen to.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Usually I get a groan out of you, so that's pretty good. Good.
So a friendly reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professions through BCU Health at curbsiders.bcuhealth.org. And friendly reminder, if you listen to this episode and complete the CME, it can be used to count towards the new DEA 8-hour requirement on substance use disorders education. So Let's jump into meeting and chatting more with Dr. Merlin. Jesse, we are so happy to have you here today. We would love for our guests to have the opportunity to get to know you a little bit better. So do you mind giving us a one-liner about yourself?
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. So I'm Jesse Merlin, and I am a scientist that focuses on the intersection of opioid misuse and opioid use disorder across populations and settings. So populations like people with advanced cancer and HIV, and settings like office-based addiction treatment programs and primary care, specialty care.
That's super cool. It sounds like, in my personal opinion, very useful research and science to be studying too. So I'm glad we have you and get to talk to you today. How did you, I mean, I feel like everybody's story and journey to addiction is so unique and usually interesting. And so, like, how'd you wind up there?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. It's always fun to share that. So I'm a physician. I'm still very active clinically. And it all started when I was a med student and I spent a few months in Botswana. This was back in the early 2000s. So people were coming to the hospital dying of AIDS. And I got really interested in taking care of people with HIV. And so I knew I wanted to do an ID fellowship. I also knew that I wanted to really help people with pain and other symptoms, because as people were, you know, in the hospital dying of AIDS, and, you know, folks in the outpatient clinics were starting to get their antiretrovirals, folks had a pretty high burden of chronic pain, acute pain, and other symptoms. And so, you know, I realized that my very smart ID attending mentors there didn't really know how to manage those things. And so I decided to pursue both an ID fellowship and a palliative care fellowship. And when I got out of fellowship, my first clinic that I ran, my first ambulatory experience as an attending, was a palliative care clinic for people with HIV in name, but really what it was a chronic pain clinic for people with HIV. And this was in 2011, tons of people on high dose opioids, not doing well. So all manner of not doing well. Some people just, you know, poor function, some people with opioid misuse challenges, and other people, you know, with frank opioid use disorder. And I realized that after all that clinical training, I had no understanding of what I was seeing and no approach to manage it. And so I decided I either had to run screaming away from the fire, screaming towards the fire, and I chose towards the fire and decided to, you know, really take a deep dive into addiction medicine, and ultimately became boarded and did a lot of sort of self-directed training through going to amazing conferences like IMRSA and CPDD, and, you know, availing myself of various ASAM resources, and then started practicing addiction medicine.
I'm so glad you ran towards the fire. I feel like that's a great analogy for, like, what a lot of us, what draws a lot of people sometimes to us to say, like, we want to try and help support and and care for patients the best we can.
Yes. And I say fire with all the love in my heart, because truly, like, you know, one of the best things about our specialty is that, you know, we can really see tangible improvement quickly. It's so gratifying. And oftentimes we're the ones with the fire extinguisher when no one else has one, right? We're the ones with the tools. And, you know, truly, maybe in a space where there aren't others who are able to do that. And that is an incredibly gratifying space to be in.
Yeah. Yeah. Second, love that. I mean, I talk about, like, with hospitalists all the time, they're like, how do you do this? And it's like, well, like, once you have the tools, it's like kind of easy. I mean, easy at times, but it's also, like, amazingly gratifying, because you're the one that gets to come in and it's be the selfish hero to help people, you know. It's, like, pretty fun.
Right. Well, and also the doc for the other docs, right? I think there's so much moral distress around treating patients with addiction that comes from all the stigma we've internalized and many other things. And so, you know, being the clinician who can help support those other clinicians as they're, you know, trying to, when they don't have those tools or those skills, I think is really gratifying too.
And boy, oh boy, do we have a case for you today. I was talking about Sean earlier that we were so excited to have you because we're like, let's ask her all the toughest questions that we don't know how to manage. So Sean, do you want to kick off with our case?
I would love to because I'm excited to learn. So we have a 55-year-old man, past medical history of diabetes with neuropathy, lumbar stenosis, and anxiety, and has a history of opioid use disorder, is currently on 24 milligrams of buprenorphine daily. He's had chronic pain since a motor vehicle accident about a decade ago that resulted in a crush injury, lots of surgeries, fasciotomy, and kind of a functional decline related to that, and has been kind of in sustained remission and in recovery from his opioid use disorder for about 15 years, but has noticed more recently that the pain is really starting to get to him, and the pain is kind of leading to more and more opioid cravings that he's starting to get worried about. He's intermittently gone to the emergency department for his worsening chronic pain and has gotten some prescriptions for 15 milligrams of oxycodone that he's been able to take up to 3 times daily and felt like that really helped him function. And he comes to you asking, how can you help me function better? Can you continue this oxycodone in the long term? Says that he's been seen by pain management in the past, tried injections that didn't help, has heard that methadone may be better for pain, and also is wondering what else he can do should he switch to that. And so I know that's a kind of big, but hopefully very familiar case for a lot of people, but like starting with the big picture, how, like, is there a good definition for like what chronic pain is? How common is it? And how common does it overlap with opioid use disorder?
Gosh, there's so much to unpack in this case. I hope I can do it justice. So chronic pain is just very simply defined as pain that lasts for at least 3 months beyond the period of normal tissue healing. So some people might have a traumatic event or be, you know, have an acute illness or have an acute exacerbation of a chronic illness, like, for example, rheumatoid arthritis, and not end up with pain when they don't have ongoing inflammation, and then other people continue to have pain. And so that's really what chronic pain is. And there are some definitions of chronic pain that talk about how many days per month. You can think about it also as whether it's high-impact chronic pain, which is pain that significantly impacts quality of life. Chronic pain impacts 20% of the U.S. population, and 6% of the U.S. population has high-impact chronic pain. This is based on 2022 CDC data. And so this is something that touches so many people that I know when I'm, you know, talking to a large audience, as I know this is, given your very popular podcast, that most people either, you know, have personal experience with chronic pain or have somebody that they love who has chronic pain. And then when you think about that intersection of chronic pain and addiction, you know, I like to just step back for a second and think about what my colleague Joe Dietry and his group have termed the reciprocal model of pain and addiction. So this idea that pain can be a powerful driver of substance use across all substances. Obviously, we think a lot about opioids, and that's the context here, but also alcohol, stimulants. These are all things that provide short-term relief, but in the longer term can actually make chronic pain worse. And then if you think about how addiction might drive pain, certainly withdrawal from substances can drive pain. Hyperalgesia can drive pain for people who are on opioids chronically, for example. So you can sort of see there's this loop, right? So pain causing addiction, addiction causing pain. And sometimes actually, I think, you know, patients will describe cravings, and when you ask them what they mean, sometimes it's pain. And sometimes people will describe pain and the need to take an opioid, and it really sounds like what they're describing is craving. So, I think one of the big clinical challenges here is I think a lot of people are in this mindset of, does this patient have pain or does this patient have addiction? And the answer is yes, they have both. They can have both. And when they have both, it's not that they have these two separate disorders that don't have anything to do with each other. The way we think about chronic pain and addiction in people who have both really ought to be focused at that intersection and the way that these two comorbidities interact with one another in that individual.
I love that. I think it just highlights how intertwined they are and that you can't just ignore one or the other. I think that sometimes it's tempting to do as a clinician, right? Address the one that I have more tools to do.
Yeah.
It's really hard to honestly manage both of those conditions individually, even more challenging, yep. I think, if somebody has both.
100%. And, you know, this case also illustrates a couple other things that I can't help but point out, right? So trauma. So, you know, this person experienced a terrible physical traumatic event. And so we also know that PTSD is very closely related to both chronic pain and addiction. And the other thing that this case illustrates is, and I'm maybe reading into it a little bit, but forgive me for that, because I think I'm probably accurate here, that sort of fragmented care, right? So this person, you know, clearly has seen surgeons, you know, probably has seen an addiction doc or a primary care doc giving them, or clinician giving them their 24 milligrams of bup. And then he's seen, you know, a pain specialist, right, who undoubtedly is not the same person that's been prescribing him the bup. So, you know, but this is one person with one very complicated experience. And so oftentimes the tools to kind of put that all together for one person just don't exist in our modern healthcare system. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Journal Feed. Audience, if you're like me, then maybe you feel like you're drowning in the medical literature. I have to do a lot of reading for this job. I love it, but sometimes I need some help. There's over a million articles that hit PubMed every year, and who has time to read all of them? If you don't want to miss out on the articles that really change your practice and might shift the way you care for your patients, then you need a solution. And that's where Journal Feed comes in. Journalfeed.org is like a nerdy colleague who skims the literature for you. That's right, for you. Practicing physicians read and summarize the most important internal medicine, primary care, and family medicine articles and deliver them to your inbox every weekday morning. You get a one-line spoon-feed summary, a short, practical rundown of the article, and even CME credit. Yep, just for reading. It's fast, it's easy, and honestly, it's fun. They don't take themselves too seriously, but they do take the science seriously. Try Journal Feed free for 7 days and get 20% off your first year with code CURB25 at journalfeed.org/curb. That's journalfeed.org/curb and use the promo code CURB25. This episode is brought to you by Freed. Do you feel you can never get ahead of charting? Well, imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. And I can tell you from personal experience that this works. I've been using Freed for over a year and a half now, and I love it. It is so great to be unburdened by all this medical documentation. Freed listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in our style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine that great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. Go to freed.ai and start your free trial today. No credit card needed. Use the code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. That's freed.ai and use the code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month.
And I think you have started to go into this a little bit. So what do you think are the biggest mistakes and misconceptions that clinicians have in the management of patients with chronic pain and opioid use disorder?
Yeah. I mean, I think, so one is, you know, and I think I'm repeating myself a little bit, but I think it bears amplifying just that one can have both. How they intersect is important. And actually asking people how that works for them, how that intersection manifests in them can be important. So asking people if their cravings feel painful or if they are really describing pain, asking them if, you know, their stimulant use helps their pain temporarily and is partially driven by pain, getting a sense of what treating their pain may do to their substance use and what treating their substance use may do to their pain. Those are all, and getting their sort of insights into that, those are all things that are really important. And, you know, really understanding the patient's priorities. I think a lot of times, and this is just true in general medicine, right? Where I think it's a sort of classic cliche, right? That, like, you know, we're just very interested in people's chronic conditions. You know, we want their A1Cs to be a target and we want their cholesterol to be a target. And we want all their screenings to be checked off and all of those things. Whereas some, you know, oftentimes what the literature suggests that patients prioritize highly are things that are symptomatic. And some people may not see their opioid use disorder or their other substance use disorder that way, right? They may not have insight into the fact that they have it. They may have it and be well treated for it, and it's no longer symptomatic. So they're not as attuned to that. And pain typically makes it to the top of lists of things that people care about. And so the entry point for some people to addressing their substance use may, in fact, be their pain. We actually have a clinical trial that is trying to test that hypothesis with opioid misuse and opioid use disorder. Like, is addressing pain as the entry point the thing that might get somebody engaged in care? I think that's an important question and something we can kind of play with in our own practice. And there's lots we can offer people for their pain, even if they don't really want to be engaged in treatment for their substance use. We should be able to respect that and still take care of their pain. Another thing I think people sometimes get caught up in is, like, which came first, the addiction or the pain, and kind of trying to attribute personal fault to one or the other. Of course, you know, we see that a lot in addiction, but I think, you know, well, this person has pain because they had so much trauma from, you know, all the times that they've been intoxicated. Of course, they're going to have pain, you know, whatever, that type of thing. And it's just, it doesn't really matter which came first, and you're not going to be able to figure it out. And it doesn't, and one shouldn't be really trying to attribute fault, certainly. You know, that's obviously very stigmatizing. You know, what's important is to try to understand where things came from to some degree, and do an appropriate workup where that's indicated, but then, you know, focus on management.
Yeah. I love the point of, like, not, one, prioritizing what the patient's prioritizing, but, like, not getting caught up in the little details if they're not going to impact the patient's priorities and what you need to do now to help them. And I think you got a lot into kind of what kind of assessment you do and what are the priorities, but can you talk us through a little bit about, like, when you're thinking about how to help this person and help their priorities, like, what do you look for in the history? What do you look for, physical exam, functional assessment, to help guide you and guide them, I guess, too?
Absolutely. So, you know, in the pain world, we're all about function, right? So it's a very different person who has a 10 out of 10 pain but is working a full-time job or taking care of a family member versus somebody who has 10 out of 10 pain but is bedbound and, you know, their life space doesn't exceed their bedroom. So it's important to assess function, and there are very easy ways to do that. There's something called the PEG, which is an acronym. It stands for pain severity, that's the P, and then the impact of pain on E, enjoyment of life, and G, general activity. And that's all on a scale of 0 to 10. And you can ask folks that at the point of care and just repeat that. I have it baked into my note template so I can follow it over time. And I just ask people that in my visits just to get a sense of how they're doing over time. I think that another thing to keep in mind is that when it comes to people's pain, pain is really often underdiagnosed. So when people present to opioid treatment settings or addiction treatment settings or are seeing their primary care clinician for substance use treatment, they may be reluctant to, there's evidence to suggest that they're maybe reluctant to disclose pain because they may think that they'll be labeled as, you know, quote unquote, drug seeking. I hate that term, but sometimes that's, you know, maybe the best way to describe how people are concerned about how they may be viewed. And so the only way to know if somebody has pain is to ask. I mean, unless they disclose it, right? So, and if you don't ask, you'll miss it. And so really making sure that if you're treating people with addiction, that you're screening for pain, and then vice versa, if you're treating people who have pain, you know, taking a good substance use history, which is probably not something that's hard to explain to this audience of how to do that. But sometimes it can get a little bit complicated, right? Especially when you're talking about opioids. So if somebody's being prescribed opioids, and this is a whole nother conversation that I'm happy to get into, but if somebody's being prescribed opioids and you want to talk to them about how they're using their opioids, the DSM criteria were really built for so-called, you know, non-medical use, right? And not really for how people might experience opioid use disorder in the context of a prescribed opioid. And so sometimes that's just something you have to take a little extra time to tease out. And I'm happy to kind of give some tips for that. The other thing I would say in terms of history is, you know, you are probably not the first person that this individual has discussed their pain and addiction with, right? I mean, maybe you are, but, you know, especially if you're a specialist, but even if you're not, most people have had some other interaction with the healthcare system before you, and it may not have been a good one. And so, especially for our patients from minoritized communities, this is really important, that intersectional stigma between race and substance use. And also pain, right? So we know that there's pain stigma. There's opioid stigma associated with taking prescribed opioids, substance use stigma, all of that. And so people may have this multi-layered experience before getting to you that may color the way that they approach that interaction with you. And so trying to come at it from a place of understanding and empathy and curiosity, I think, is really critical. You know, I'm often referred patients who, you know, like other folks have just had so much trouble communicating with, you know, and I get that. But a lot of that is just this overlay of patient anger and frustration and mistrust that's pretty well earned by the healthcare system. And so sometimes, you know, just hearing about their prior experiences and just naming it, like, it sounds like you've had some really stigmatizing, unfair, uncalled for experiences. And I am sorry that that happened to you. And, you know, what I can do is tell you how you'll be treated in this clinic and how I will personally treat you and what you can expect going forward. So I think validating it, naming it, and then setting some expectations for how things will be different is important.
How long does your initial visit tend to take?
Yeah, I mean, I work in, like, you know, the ivory tower of academia, so my initial visit is an hour. So my current practice is I run a palliative care clinic that's embedded in an office-based addiction treatment program, basically a buprenorphine oriented addiction treatment program that also has its integrated primary care. But I do palliative care. I see people who have advanced cancer as their reason for pain typically, and opioid misuse, opioid use disorder, other substance use disorders. And so my initial visit is an hour. I try to cover all of that related to their pain and addiction. And then oftentimes we're also talking about challenges related to their serious illness, about advanced care planning and prognosis and all of that. Sometimes it's not all in one visit. That's the other thing about
I was going to say, I'm impressed if you can get that all in an hour.
No, of course not. And I think that's the other thing, right, is like sometimes these issues, they feel so urgent, right? Like, especially someone's pain, you want to be responsive. But, you know, and I am very empathetic to that. And I will often name that for people, like, I know you wish your pain could go away yesterday. Like, you know, I feel that. And I know you feel it more than I do. And you didn't get here overnight. We're not going to get you out of this overnight. But I'm here to stick with you and to help figure this out and work with you over time. And so sometimes that initial conversation is really the initial three or four conversations where you sort of unpack all of this and you build trust and build rapport. Yeah.
I appreciate that tip of, like, naming the urgency to the patient, but also outlining of how you can't obviously get to everything in one visit or fix something that's been going on for 15 years in a visit. It sounds like, I mean, you kind of cover that role of both addiction and palliative care. What do you feel like the role is for meds for opioid disorder, like particularly buprenorphine for chronic pain? And I guess, is that a very different for people with overlap versus people with just, I don't want to say just chronic pain, but maybe chronic pain is not what you do.
You can say just chronic pain.
Just chronic pain.
Don't worry, it won't offend me. And just to be clear, I'm talking about this sort of outside the serious illness context. If you add serious illness like cancer on top of it, there's, you know, some additional considerations, but, you know, the principles are really remain the same. But buprenorphine is obviously an evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder. It's also an FDA-approved medication for pain. There are, as you all well know, lots of different formulations and, you know, ways to prescribe it. But bottom line, it is an opioid that can be used for chronic pain. How good is buprenorphine for chronic pain? Well, I think it's just as good as all other opioids. Not that good, but it's a tool in your toolbox. And if your patient is already on it, it's reasonable to see how you might use that buprenorphine to help treat their pain too. We don't know how to best use buprenorphine to treat chronic pain. This is a limitation, right? So these ultra-low-dose formulations of buprenorphine are FDA-approved to treat chronic pain. So things like the patch and the buckle version that are in the microgram range. But those do not treat opioid use disorder. So for most of the patients we're thinking about, those are not appropriate. When you get into the milligram world of products, which is usually where we are operating, right, there's a lot less guidance on dosing and how to optimize people's treatment. We actually have a trial right now that is testing whether increasing people's doses in a patient-oriented way based on pain, not cravings and not withdrawal, up to 32 milligrams is more effective at treating people's pain and keeping them retained in office-based addiction treatment than treatment as usual, which is just, you know, whatever people normally do with bup dosing, you know, which is a story in and of into itself, right? Because, I mean, what is that? You know, it's a lot of different things. It's a lot of, you know, influenced by local practice patterns and state policies and all kinds of things, insurance. But nevertheless, our hypothesis is that higher doses of buprenorphine will be more effective for chronic pain than lower doses of buprenorphine. This is based on a lot of anecdotal experience, people just doing this. And we said, people are just doing this. We should see if this works, because if it does, we really ought to argue to states that disallow going over a certain number of milligrams or make it really hard by making their Medicaid programs not cover it. We should really go to those states and say, hey, this works if it works. And if it doesn't, we shouldn't put our efforts there. So we are, you know, about halfway through that trial. Yeah. So, and then in terms of methadone, you know, there are no head-to-head trials of bup versus methadone for chronic pain. Methadone, again, has a similar type of literature to buprenorphine in the sense that it's, you know, does it work for chronic pain? Yeah, just about as poorly as all other opioids. I mean, I think the evidence base is pretty similar. Obviously, the challenge, right, is that it's in a parallel system of care. And there are phenomenal methadone clinics out there, so please don't misunderstand me. There are, you know, I'm not disparaging methadone clinics, and if you've seen one methadone clinic, you've seen one methadone clinic. And there are, you know, there's a lot of geographical variation in quality and also in flexibility. And what that translates to is, you know, differences in whether people are going to be able to get split dosing, which from a pharmacologic perspective makes a whole lot more sense with methadone. also, I think, you know, there are anecdotally, and I wonder if you guys had the same experience, right? There are some methadone clinics that are like, no, we don't treat pain. We treat substance use disorder. So unless the patient says that they have a substance use disorder, they can't come here, right? And I think some of that comes from the way that methadone initiation is regulated, where the person has to demonstrate an opioid use disorder for a period of time. So if somebody does not identify as having an opioid use disorder, but more so identifies as having pain, then that may not be an option for them. Whereas with buprenorphine, you know, I think people are much more flexible in their thinking and able to be much more flexible in their thinking in terms of office-based buprenorphine. Like, am I treating their pain or am I treating their addiction? Do they acknowledge that they have addiction? Do I care? Like, if they're on fire and I have the fire extinguisher and I put out their fire, does it matter why? You know, do we need to, how deeply do we need to drill into this person's psyche? Probably not very deeply. Like, if they're better, they're better. But that type of flexibility just often isn't available in methadone settings. So it's a shame because, you know, we don't have that many tools pharmacologically, and to not have full access to all the tools that there are is an absolute shame.
I think that was a really great overview of just kind of how you think through bup and methadone, kind of the very honest limitations in the literature and kind of that opioids aren't always our best option. I think for kind of some of our listeners who maybe aren't the most familiar with medications for opioid use disorder or like kind of how to optimally dose sometimes, do you think you could go over a little bit about like MOUD and how it's regulated a little bit too?
100%. So there are three FDA-approved medications for opioid use disorder. So there is buprenorphine, specifically in the milligram range, because there are also products, of course, in the microgram range, but milligram range buprenorphine-based products. There is methadone, and there is naltrexone. Real quick, just to get naltrexone out of the way, there, interestingly, in studies of naltrexone, people who had chronic pain in some of those initial studies actually did better on naltrexone than placebo. But naltrexone is an opioid blocker, and it's also less effective for opioid use disorder. It's just not great options. Like, people aren't retained in it as well long term. So it's not as good as the other two. I think in our field, we really just, even in people who just have opioid use disorder, we really rely a lot on buprenorphine and methadone, certainly accounting for patient preference. Sometimes people want naltrexone. But so then when you're thinking about methadone and buprenorphine, you know, for opioid use disorder, we know what some of those advantages and disadvantages are, right? So there is better evidence for retention in methadone treatment. However, you know, methadone is really provided in a separate system of care. So in this country, in order to prescribe methadone for opioid use disorder, you have to be an opioid treatment program, so a licensed opioid treatment program. Now, quick digression, but a relevant one. If you want to prescribe methadone for pain in this country, no problem. You just have to have a DEA. That is stigma manifested, right? So it is perfectly acceptable to integrate methadone into routine care if the person has pain, but not if they have opioid use disorder. So so just kind of wanted to point that out. And in the palliative care world, a lot of people use methadone for pain. It's actually very common. So, you know, a lot of times for pain, we talk about split dosing methadone, which can be really hard to do in the context of an opioid treatment program, because oftentimes, you know, people are going every day or, you know, especially at the beginning. Of course, you know, there are all the new loosening of regulations, but many programs aren't taking those up. So, but long story short, you know, a lot of times people do not get to take home any methadone. There's really no practical mechanism, unless they're going to come twice a day, which is not a thing, to get them to split dose that methadone. And from a pharmacologic perspective, that would be what makes the most sense. For buprenorphine, similarly, from a pharmacologic perspective, it seems like it would make the most sense to split the dose. So instead of having somebody take all 16, 24, 32 milligrams in the morning, if they have also have chronic pain, split the dose throughout the day. And this has been described in the literature. there's no evidence base for that, right? There's no like randomized trial of split dosing versus not split dosing buprenorphine. We have a study where we're interested in understanding optimal buprenorphine dosing for people with opioid use disorder and chronic pain. And the intervention that we're looking at there is what we're calling patient-oriented dosing, which is dosing buprenorphine up to 32 milligrams split up to four times a day. So basically 8 milligrams, four times a day. Versus treatment as usual, which is just whatever people are doing. And, you know, I think people are often split dosing it. I should say clinicians are often explicitly split dosing it. If they aren't, our patients are doing it anyway. And I think there's a lot of practice pattern variation based on region from what I can tell from my experience, both as a researcher and a clinician in this space, as to whether people are split dosing and how often they're doing that.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. You know what doesn't belong in your epic summer plans? Getting burned by your old wireless bill. While you're planning beach trips, barbecues, and three-day weekends, your wireless bill should be the last thing holding you back, and that's why you should make the switch to Mint Mobile. Say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you. All their plans come with high-speed data, unlimited talk and text, on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. Ditch the overpaid wireless and get free months of premium wireless service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. I have a family member who needs a new phone, and guess what I'm using? Mint Mobile. This year, skip breaking a sweat and breaking the bank. Get your summer savings and shop premium wireless at mintmobile.com/curb. That's mintmobile.com/curb. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, 5 gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 per month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
So thinking back to our case a little bit, let us say that we have sort of reviewed and the patient reminds us as well that he's taking some over-the-counter medicines like acetaminophen, naproxen, to try and help their pain. And I am curious about how you sort of think about other sort of non-pharmacologic options into pain management for these patients. Like, are there any behavioral interventions that you think are effective for this population? And if so, how do you sort of get buy-in from the patient or even find those resources in your area?
Yeah, great question. Well, I really especially appreciate this question because I'm a PhD-trained behavioral scientist, so the reason I decided to get a PhD in behavioral science was because I was seeing a lot of patients in that clinic that I mentioned before that I, you know, was my first attending clinic, who were on opioids and other pharmacologic therapies for chronic pain and were not doing well, and I was interested in understanding what other evidence-based options were. So in the general chronic pain world, behavioral interventions are regarded as among the most effective, if not the most effective, and the safest intervention. And when I say behavioral interventions for chronic pain, what's typically been studied is cognitive behavioral therapy, so sort of classic cognitive behavioral therapy for chronic pains, often like 12 sessions, and includes all the typical elements of cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive restructuring, all of that. And there are protocols for cognitive behavioral therapy specific to chronic pain. There are also manualized versions of cognitive behavioral therapy called pain self-management programs that also derive from the chronic disease self-management model and focus not so much on the cognitions, but on the behaviors and reinforcing the behaviors. So there's a lot of goal setting, a lot of feedback, a lot of modeling of behaviors, which can be done using peers, a lot of practicing behaviors as a way to improve people's pain self-efficacy and therefore change their behaviors around a myriad of things, including being physically active despite having chronic pain, sleeping well to improve your chronic pain, mood and pain, using strategies other than medications for pain. And then there are also mindfulness-based interventions. A lot of times, pain self-management and CBT incorporates mindfulness, but there are also mindfulness-focused interventions. These are all evidence-based approaches. The 2017 National Pain Strategy, which was the most recently updated iteration of the National Pain Strategy, recommended that pain self-management interventions be essentially widely adopted and disseminated because they've been shown to be effective and they're highly manualized. So they don't need to be delivered by a clinical psychologist the way that cognitive behavioral therapy might, or the way that mindfulness might, but they can be delivered by somebody who is trained on a pain self-management manual. So a lot of my work has really focused on essentially adapting pain self-management for different populations. We know with behavioral interventions, that's really important. You generally can't just pull things off the shelf, especially when you're talking about populations that have a lot of other psychological and social factors at play, like people with substance use disorders. And so we adapted a pain self-management intervention specifically for patients with opioid use disorder, and we're testing it currently in a clinical trial. There have only been just a handful of trials looking at any interventions in people with pain and opioid use disorder. So really mainly mindfulness, and that has been shown to be effective. There are a couple of groups working on that. But aside from that, there really isn't much in that overlap space. And so we're hoping to contribute to that with our work in pain self-management. But all that fun research stuff doesn't really help the frontline clinician today. Hopefully help you one day, but not today. So what I would say in terms of integrating that into your practice, a couple things. One is that knowing that these strategies work for people, these behavioral approaches work for people, means that you can sort of integrate them a little bit into how you interact with people. There's nothing magical about working with people on goal setting, and checking back in with them about that. That's not something that has to be done in a behavioral intervention context. It can be done between, a clinician, medical clinician, nurse, practitioner, PA, whatever, and a patient. So that's one thing. Another thing is trying to find what those local resources are. So it can be hyper-local, it can be in your clinic. So I think we often underutilize our interdisciplinary team colleagues' skills and may not realize that, maybe the social worker in the clinic actually has expertise in doing CBT, never for chronic pain, but you could send her a copy of Managing Chronic Pain Before It Manages You, which is actually a CBT self-help manual. And that social worker could probably figure out how to apply those lessons to the standard CBT that they've been, administering. So, you might find things like that within your practice setting. And if you go to the American Psychological Association's website and you type in pain, you will find pain psychologists. And just like any other psychologist, if the patient's insurance covers therapy by a psychologist, it will cover that. And so if you have somebody who is insured, or if you can find some, or they may be underinsured, you have to see whether it covers it. But oftentimes you can actually build a little local network of people who can help with these folks.
First of all, thank you for ending the kind of what we're hoping to do with the what we can actually do now. I think that's so useful to all of us, including me, that struggles in these cases. But do you have it for the goal setting discussion? Do you have any tips on how to actually have that conversation with patients or around the goal setting with chronic pain?
Yes. So learning what people wish they could do but can't, despite their chronic pain, is a good first step. And sometimes those things are really lofty and you kind of have to break them down into something a little bit less lofty. Like, you know, I remember a patient who's like, well, I used to be a marathon runner. I'd really like to run a marathon. You know, if you're not leaving your bed, running a marathon is a very distal goal, and that's a really great goal. Like, you know, what is it about marathon running that you love? You know, and trying to understand if it's that physical activity piece, and then thinking about SMART goals. So specific, measurable. Oh, I'm horrible at this. Something, and time bound. What does a SMART goal stand for? I don't know. But, you know, thinking of SMART goals for people to, you know, and working with people on those, recognizing that the goals that people set are really best driven by their own ideas. People will come up with way better ideas than you or I ever will about what the right next step is to take. Like, I remember a patient that I had once who used to scuba dive and was like, you know, I remember someone telling me that the high school in my neighborhood allows people to swim in their pool. Like, I would never have thought of that. Like, I didn't, you know, how would I know he's a scuba diver? How would I know high school in his neighborhood that, you know, so, but just talking to, like, physical activity is important to him. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, so the next step is what next step do you think you can take to explore that? And it's like, well, I'm going to call the high school. I'm going to go down to the high school, you know, and just check it out. You know, like, that's a great goal. Let's check back in about that. So the other thing that I like to ask people is how they spend their days. I feel like that's a very telling kind of question because, you know, a lot of my patients are on disability and their days look very different than ours. They're not getting up in the morning and going somewhere to work. But that doesn't mean that they're not getting up and doing something, right? So people have full-time volunteer things that they do. People are caregivers for family members. People, you know, find ways to be active in their local communities. And some people don't. Some people really struggle and are more limited to their homes. And so just really trying to understand that, I think, gives you a glimpse into, you know, am I going to be working on a marathon training schedule with this person, or am I going to be working on, you know, them walking to the mailbox? You know, it's a very different thing.
I'm curious how you get buy-in with patients and what your sort of spiel is to them. I feel like I have very unsuccessfully pitched the idea of, like, CBT for pain for many patients and just probably not doing a great job of it. So how do you sort of chat with patients about these referrals that you place?
Yeah, that's a really hard one. I mean, I think acknowledging that behavioral interventions aren't for everyone. I mean, I'm a behavioral scientist and I think behavioral interventions are great and I'd love everybody to participate in them where they're applicable. And they're just not on everybody's, you know, dance card. It's just trying to keep it patient-centered and patient preference-centered. And also recognizing that one can always return to it over time, letting people know kind of that, am I planting that seed, that motivational interviewing seed about the existence of something might be just enough for somebody to come back to. But the way that I typically describe behavioral interventions, including CBT for pain, is that, you know, I'll ask people, what do you do in your daily life when you have pain? Like, there, you know, what are your strategies to deal with pain so that you can keep doing the things you need to do that day? You know, some people will say, I don't, I just lay down and go to bed. So, you know, that's a strategy. It's not maybe the one that we would hope for because it doesn't really promote function. But many people, if you persist, like, okay, sometimes you're going to lay down and go to bed, but, like, what if you're out? What if you can't? You know, what do you do? And so, people, if they dig down deep enough, they usually can come up with something. Like, I call my daughter. I go for a walk around the block. I, you know, listen to music. I try to, you know, to take some deep breaths. So I say, look, these are great self-management strategies. You're already doing this. So you're already figuring out the things in your daily life that help you, you know, put pain in the background so you can keep doing what you want to do. And there's actually a coach for that kind of thing. There are people who are trained to coach folks with chronic pain in those skills, help them hone those skills, identify additional skills when that's possible. And I have no doubt that you're already doing this and good at it. And, you know, even the best baseball players need coaches, right? Everybody needs a coach for, you know, to optimize their skills. That's often how I kind of explain it. I don't know if that resonates with you guys, but I feel like that tends to resonate with folks because it validates what they're already doing and validates their need for more, not as like a deficiency, because it really isn't, but as like an optimization that anybody in their situation would need.
Yeah. I mean, I don't do that, but I feel like I will do that.
Well, everybody's going to be like, why are all my doctors talking about baseball? I don't actually, I'm not a sports person, so I don't know why I'm talking about baseball, but that's what I always say.
We have a pain psychologist that I have been unsuccessful in referring patients to. So I hope that they get a message saying, why does everybody call me coach?
Yeah, exactly. What's going on here?
So say you do all this, they get involved with a pain psychologist because you are the most convincing person I've ever talked to. And but they still come back to you and they're like, I really feel like I need to restart these opioids. They were the thing that really made me the most functional. Are there clinical situations? And again, like maybe outside the more palliative care realm, but like, yes. Are there clinical situations you think about restarting opioids, and how do you set expectations? You have dose, like how do you functionally actually do it too?
Yep. So not to sidestep that question, but I want to say first that providing people with multiple approaches, both pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic, is really key because no one approach has a very large effect size. So the thing that tends to work the best, the thing with the best evidence base historically has been, you know, multidisciplinary pain clinics that can really provide multiple different treatment strategies to people so that you're really combining effect size. I think one thing that we have not done very well in the modern era of studying pain in the context of addiction or not is figuring out what are the key components to those multidisciplinary approaches, and how do you really personalize that to what an individual is interested in, is willing to do, has the ability to do. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about behavioral approaches, but there are other things. There are movement-based approaches, so things like yoga and tai chi that are evidence-based. There's acupuncture. I'm sure I'm leaving something out because, you know, you'll always leave out somebody's favorite evidence-based chronic pain treatment. But those are really, and then, of course, you know, you mentioned opioids, but of course there are other medications. Gabapentinoids, unfortunately, are dramatically overprescribed and their evidence base is very poor. That's a whole conversation in and of itself. That's a really great example of pharmaceutical company marketing. There's been lots written about that. Duloxetine is another one. Treating people's comorbid depression with whatever antidepressant you like or they like or they've had positive experiences with in the past, you know, also really important. So there are a lot of different things that one can and should think about with somebody. And I think that takes the pressure a little bit off of focusing on any one individual treatment, whether that's a behavioral treatment that you feel like you have the perfect pain psychologist and would love for them to see that person, or the opioid that the patient is asking for. Hopefully it kind of relieves that pressure valve a little bit to point out that there's a whole world of treatments out there, and your job is to help them think about the benefits and risks of any or all of them based on, you know, their individual needs, including their comorbid opioid use disorder, especially when we're talking about pharmacologic treatments. So to your specific question about opioids and when to consider opioids, I want to address this essentially for the general population and not in people with a limited prognosis. But I will say that we did a Delphi study trying to understand how one would make that decision in people with advanced cancer. And really what it came down to was prognosis. And so people who had a prognosis of greater than a year, the clinicians participating in our study really felt like it was a whole lot less appropriate to prescribe full agonist opioids if they have a comorbid opioid use disorder. This was specifically among people with chronic pain and a comorbid opioid use disorder. So with that framing, right, of, you know, if you have chronic pain and an opioid use disorder, full agonist opioids are least appropriate if we think you're going to live a long time. Every decision about opioids comes down to benefits versus risks. And if you simplify it that way, I think it demystifies and takes a lot of pressure off, because you can think with somebody about the potential benefits to them and the potential harms. And you want to do it in a patient-centered way, also recognizing that there are going to be limits to what you're willing to do, because as the clinician in the room, you feel that the harms absolutely, the potential for harms, the risks absolutely outweigh the potential for benefits based on their opioid use disorder history, other substance use disorders, comorbid psychiatric illness. Sometimes we have to make that judgment call, and it's not easy because, you know, patients will sometimes say to me, it's unfair that you get to be the one to make that decision. And, you know, yes, I get that that feels very unfair. And because I'm the one writing the prescription, that is how it is. And there's, you know, and I'll say, like, just like there are some boundaries that you have around, you know, for example, you've said that, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy isn't something that you want to participate in. You don't want to try buprenorphine. Like, I respect that. And there are some boundaries that I have. And one of those is, in this case, prescribing full agonist opioids, you know, if that's the case. You know, opioids are not an evidence-based treatment for chronic pain, really. So lots of good systematic reviews about this. Aaron Krebs did a great trial, the SPACE trial in, oh, I think it was 2018, comparing opioids to NSAIDs for chronic pain, no difference. So opioids are really just not a strongly evidence-based treatment for chronic pain. Now, does that mean that they don't work for anybody? No. Does that mean that if we had personalized medicine-based approaches, we could do better? Yes, of course. I mean, so much of how people respond to opioids has to do with genetics, both in terms of benefits and harms. Like, are there some people who are going to respond really well and some people who are going to respond really poorly and have harms? Yes. Can we figure out who those people are at the point of care when we're evaluating somebody? No, unfortunately. You know, we don't really have those tools. Like, yes, there are things like the opioid risk tool, but those have been shown to be no better than the flip of a coin, and also are often highly racialized. Ask about things like criminal justice involvement. Like, they're not good. So when you have that person sitting in front of you, it gets back to that risk, weighing that risk and benefit of the opioid, which is sadly a judgment call. And so you assess what the patient's individual risk factors are, which generally are current or prior substance use disorder, psychiatric comorbidities. And you know in those situations that the risk is going to be greater. And then you have an informed consent-based conversation, and you know what your limits are, what you feel is appropriate. And I never feel like giving somebody buprenorphine is second rate. Buprenorphine is no better or worse than another opioid. It just isn't. And so if somebody isn't already on an opioid, whether they have opioid use disorder or not, the VA now recommends buprenorphine as the first opioid to reach for when treating chronic pain if you're going to use an opioid. And so I will tell people that. The VA, which generally I think people respect, like they know that's a good place to get healthcare generally, recommends that as the first line opioid. And the evidence base for full agonist opioids is certainly no better than it is for buprenorphine. I mean, it's all kind of crappy. But like, if you're going to reach for an opioid, reach for a safe one, you know? So that's the other thing, is I reach for buprenorphine more and more as a first line, regardless of whether somebody has an opioid use disorder, other substance use disorder history or not. It also tends to have a lot less other bad stuff going on with it. So like, it's a kappa and delta antagonist, so it's better for mood. It's associated with less hyperalgesia. It's actually a lot easier to get, you know, people have horrendous practical problems getting full agonist opioids in 2025. Not to say that that doesn't exist at all for buprenorphine, because we all know that it does, but it's way worse for full agonist in my personal experience. So there are a lot of practical reasons to reach for bupe too. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it more than answered my question.
you
in a good way. In a good way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the kind of the overview of like, let's not forget there are other evidence-based things first, and not just CBT and mindfulness, but also kind of the movement things, meds like avoiding gabapentinoids, but kind of embracing antidepressants and particularly duloxetine. And then I think the thing that we all knew in our heart, which is like, there is no perfect answer to like when opioids are most appropriate, but there isn't good data for them for chronic pain. And so keeping that in mind when you individualize that kind of risk benefit discussion with patients too.
Absolutely. I think oftentimes the chronic pain conversation can become reduced to the opioid conversation. And whatever we can do to try to pull people back from that a little bit, help them think of that broader world of potential options. And then within the opioid conversation, think about all of the opioid options, particularly buprenorphine. I think those are good strategies, and they also tend to reduce that pressure valve on us and the patient, right?
I'm curious in your practice, because I do feel like many of my patients do have some sense of, hey, cold weather or certain triggers can exacerbate my chronic pain. So it gives you a little bit of that kind of like acute on chronic pain type feeling, even though really maybe there's not new tissue injury, essentially, but there was something that the person knows was triggering that worsens their chronic pain. In those circumstances, is it the same approach? Do you ever sort of consider just using them for a couple of days for acute pain flares in the setting of underlying chronic pain?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I'm going to take it a step further and say we've all seen people get hospitalized for this, right? So when people have what I would call as acute flare, I would call that an acute flare of their chronic pain, right? When someone has an underlying serious medical illness like lupus or like sickle cell, oftentimes there is reason to want to make sure that there isn't something acute going on that requires specific disease-oriented medical intervention, right? So I want to be really clear. Like, you got to make people with chronic pain, for whatever reason, whatever the source of the chronic pain is, are at very high risk of having things missed. So, you know, somebody with low back pain that now all of a sudden is way worse and has a bone met, you know, like, we don't want to miss these things. And what we also don't want to do is treat somebody's acute exacerbation of chronic pain as if it is something that it isn't. So the way that I like to talk to people about this is that chronic pain, the very nature of chronic pain is that people are going to have better days and worse days, and better weeks and better months and worse months. And generally people will say, yes, I relate to that. And what I like to do is try to understand, is what you're experiencing within that range of your typical kind of like best week, worst week range? Or is this something like way outside of that? Can you help me understand? And a lot of times people will say, no, this is, I'm having a bad week, you know? And that's the nature of chronic pain. It, throughout the day, you're going to have a better hour and a worse hour. And the trick to it is learning how to manage your pain when you're having those flares, right? And that's very different from somebody saying, no, this is something totally different. This is a pain I've never felt before. This is way worse, way different than what I typically have. If somebody has acute pain, you can, just to tweak what you said just a little bit, like I wouldn't necessarily call that acute pain. I would call that like an acute flare of somebody's chronic pain. And for that, I would not give opioids almost in any circumstance, because that is a situation that's going to repeat itself over and over and over again in their lives. And that is more or less sort of a decision to start somebody on long-term opioids from a practical perspective. And if that's not what you're intending to do, then I wouldn't. But sure, there are situations where, you know, somebody has acute pain and they warrant a full agonist opioid, whether or not they have an opioid use disorder. And, you know, I think those indications are pretty narrow and even diminishing by the day, right? So perioperatively, you know, it may be reasonable to give somebody an opioid. And a lot of people actually don't want that. They're doing, you know, these enhanced recovery after anesthesia protocols to reduce or eliminate the need for opioids perioperatively. So, but sure, like, you know, acute trauma, even then, a lot of guidelines are really recommending 3 days or less, considering alternatives, you know. But certainly, you know, people with chronic pain can have, you know, reasons for severe acute pain totally unrelated to their chronic pain. And people with opioid use disorder can be in that boat. And, you know, you weigh the risks and benefits. I often find that people who have an opioid use disorder history or current opioid use disorder actually don't want opioids. I don't know that there's any literature that gives one a number for this, but I'm often surprised by how my patients will say, actually, I know what life was like on opioids. I don't want that. And I'm the one convincing them like, hey, you're about to get radiation for your cancer. Like, this might be the time, to consider a full opioid agonist, you know, but, you know, people have legitimate worries about their own personal context, and they have preferences. Yeah. You got the whole dollar's worth again. Oops.
Whole dollar, $2 worth.
That's $2. What that
yes.
Look at that.
Are there, I guess, like any like best practices that you feel like we missed or haven't talked about, particularly for like primary care doctor in how to integrate the things we've talked about into their practice, or integrate other things, I guess, too, but.
There isn't an off-the-shelf way to really optimally treat chronic pain in primary care settings. It's all about, unfortunately, individual clinicians knowing the evidence base and putting stuff together and knowing what's available in their communities and in their health systems. Like, for example, like I know that, you know, the predominant payer in my area covers acupuncture for low back pain for a certain number of sessions. Like, you know, you just sort of, you got to figure these things out locally. So it sort of stinks to have to invent that wheel. Hopefully you team up with other people who are like-minded and want to do that too. But, and there often aren't, there really are generally not places to send these folks that do that, right? There aren't typically, I mean, there's some examples of clinics like this that do exist, but there's generally not chronic pain clinics that are integrated into primary care. Chronic pain clinics generally are dominated by an anesthesia-based model that is fairly focused on intervention. So there really kind of isn't. You know, there are resources out there. There's a website that I developed as part of a study for managing opioid misuse behaviors in primary care that also, you know, talks a lot about chronic pain management in primary care. So there are resources like that. That's opioidalgorithms.pitt.edu. So, you know, there's that. There's that book, Managing Chronic Pain Before It Manages You, which is something that if a patient is a fairly high literacy level, you can recommend to them. You can purchase it on Amazon. You know, I have a copy that is in my office that once in a while I'll loan out to somebody. So opioid use disorder as a DSM-based diagnosis really draws from behaviors we might see in individuals who are using quote-unquote non-medical opioids, opioids that are not being prescribed to them. But it may look different in people who we are the ones providing them opioids. And so some examples of that might be, so continued use despite harm. So examples of that I like to give are, you know, I had a patient once who took all their opioids and their benzodiazepine and their muscle relaxant, fell asleep, woke up, and then took them all again and had a year-long hospitalization with an LTAC, vent weaning, you know, bit in there and the whole thing. And when I saw this person after all of this in my clinic, and this person had been restarted on their opioids, which we know from Mark LaRochelle's work, people with opioid use disorder generally are often prescribed opioids. People who've had overdoses of opioids are often prescribed opioids again anyway. So it's maybe not a huge shocker. But, you know, when I saw her in my clinic and I said, hey, I'm worried about you. That's really scary what happened. I'm worried that about your opioids. And her response was, nah, it was fine. That is continued use despite harm. That's a very significant harm. Right. Repeated efforts to cut down. So, you know, somebody has been trying to taper their opioids, either self-driven, because that's a personal goal, or because their doctor has said, hey, you're on very high doses. Let's see if we can't get you down to keep things safer for you. And they can't do it. So unsuccessful efforts to cut down. Family and friends, right? So if your family member is managing your opioids, like doling them out to you, which I see a lot, you know, and it's causing interpersonal friction, as it generally does when a family member is put in that position, that might be interpersonal problems related to your opioids. So just being aware that things might look a little bit different and keeping a flexible mindset.
That's really helpful because, as you say, the cases are slightly different. People present in different ways, and it can be a little hard to tease out. And sometimes it takes me a visit or two to tease it out. Sometimes even more. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, often more. Yeah.
Yes.
It's not always clear to me. Yeah.
Well, and the challenge is that, you know, people don't document these things very clearly in the chart. And so I just really encourage people to do their best to document them so that when the next prescriber does pick up that patient, so that ED provider, or maybe you're that ED provider and someone else is trying to figure out what happened when they were there, just in the most non-judgmental, non-stigmatizing language possible, just very plainly document what you see. You know, this person is missing visits repeatedly. This person is taking more opioid than prescribed, whatever the situation is, because they're not generally great places to document this that are separate in the chart, and they can get really buried. And oftentimes people use kind of euphemisms. They say, oh, the person's quote unquote drug seeking. Like, what, that's a terrible term, but also like, what was it that you saw that makes you say that? Just say the thing. And if you really think about it, sometimes it's like, well, there is no thing. I just have this sense. That's not good. Sense just shouldn't make it into the chart. It should be concrete. So yeah. That's that pattern that you're looking for. I'll just say that one other thing. Like, it's a pattern. It's not one behavior one time. You're looking for a pattern.
Yeah, because it's super important not to inappropriately or prematurely diagnose somebody if they don't have that diagnosis, just because I feel like that opens a whole other round of challenges that that person could face just being labeled with that in the health system, especially if they don't actually have an opioid use disorder.
Well, and to that point, a lot of people will ask, should I even write that in the chart, right? Like, do I even write opioid use disorder in the chart? Do I write it without telling the person? And I think this can get really tricky, right? Because if you're prescribing buprenorphine for somebody because you think they have an opioid use disorder, you probably want to document that for the sake of future medical decision-making related to that patient. I certainly have had situations where people have, you know, where I've said to somebody, I am concerned you have an opioid use disorder, because if I'm worried about it, I will say it. And I will say, this is a side effect of opioids. It's not your fault. This is something that happens to probably about 10% of people we prescribe opioids. It's an expected side effect in about 10% of people. And sometimes people will say, please don't put that in my chart, because if you do, I'm going to be treated differently. And it's the same thing with buprenorphine, right? Please don't prescribe me buprenorphine, because if you do, I'm going to be treated differently when I show up to the ED and, you know, have appendicitis or, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, really validating that, like, I cannot argue with you that you may be treated differently. And I am sorry for that. And it's also okay if you don't agree that you have this. We can agree to disagree. That's okay. But I still recommend documenting it in the chart. It's hard. I won't say I always abide by that, because sometimes I feel stressed out about it, because I don't want to hurt the person and I want them to trust me. And at the same time, if I don't document it, then anybody else looking at the chart is going to be utterly confused. And unless they can get a hold of me and think to get a hold of me, they're not going to know what the heck to do.
Yeah. It's a tough catch 22, because you're like, you know, there's downsides both ways. And it's like, how to,
yes,
like everything else, how do you balance that? Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah. Right.
I just imagine a giant scale. We're all sort of just weighing with patients, walking around with it. I was wondering, do you have any take-home points for our listeners?
Yes, I do. People can have both chronic pain and opioid use disorder, and they can interact with each other in ways that are important. And wherever you're coming from with this, right, whatever your background is, if you're an addiction doc or addiction clinician, pain clinician, whatever, primary care, whatever your background is, you either already possess or can easily develop the tools to treat both. We don't have enough specialists in the world to send all these people to specialists. So, you know, when that patient is in front of you, you have the tools, you can do it. Treat their pain, even if you're an addiction person, quote unquote. Treat their addiction, even if you're a quote unquote pain person. Just do it. You will feel better. The patient will feel better. The experience will be better.
I love it. Very affirming. Everybody, you've got your tools or you can develop them. I genuinely feel more confident about this than I did 1.5 hours ago.
You won't tell the listeners how long we've been at this. 2 hours.
Yeah. Could be days. Who knows?
Don't know.
Yes. No. Thank you. That's very kind of you to say. I really appreciate that.
Do you have anything you'd like to plug to, like, let listeners know about? We will link to all the great resources you spoke about during our show notes. But it could be anything. It could be related to this topic, or it could be something else.
Yeah, so that website that I mentioned, I think that may be helpful to folks. And, you know, please keep an eye out for the results of the clinical trials that I mentioned. You know, I've mentioned a lot of the research that I'm doing, but I just want to kind of give a shout out that I have really wonderful colleagues and mentees that I work with day in and day out to do this work, that are really from incredible multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary backgrounds. So Devin Check, Aaron Winstanley, Katie Fitzgerald Jones, Haley Bowles, these are all folks who are a key part of all of this work. And, you know, it really takes a team to do good science.
So thank you for your time. We appreciate you.
Yeah.
Thank you. This was so much fun. I'm so honored. I'm fangirling. Real hard.
Hey, This has been another episode of our Curbsiders miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction. And if you're still hungry for more, join the Curbsiders Internal Medicine Patreon and get all episodes ad-free plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find additional show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get weekly show notes to your inbox.
And as always, we are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So subscribe, rate, review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. And a reminder that this and most of our episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org.
A very special thanks to ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about their organization at acam.org. Incredible org that has supported this episode and actually our entire season 4. And special thanks to our reviewer, Kyle Roy, for this episode and our entire Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by the team at Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris, the True Man Chu, moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed the theme music. And with that, until next time, I've been Dr. Kieran Lanjan.
And I'm Sean Cohen. Thanks for joining us and letting us bring you some Addiction Med Pearls.
You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.